The service committee gave me my ordination, and I talked about that. Basically, the ministerial service committee gave me my ordination, and I gave my sermon on racism because I thought I really knew something about it back then. That was in the late 90s. Back in the early days, it would not have ever occurred to me that there would be a book titled Between the World and Me by Nahisi Coates, who said in a letter to his son that he needed to explain to him that this was a racist country. It is, in fact, a speech that, according to Jim Wallace, must be given by every black parent in this country to let that child know that he or she is not safe just because he is an American. And so we look at our country today, and one of the things I learned during this time of my growing up period, and I have to say that started in the 60s, and I'm not sure it's done yet, but the fact is that I am always speaking from a place of white privilege. I may not acknowledge it. I may not purposely do anything, but I am always speaking from a place of white privilege. The fact that I can choose to speak about tolerance is a wonderful thing. But it's something I can choose to do. A person who is of a darker color of skin than mine can't choose to change the color of that skin, cannot choose to be accepted by people in our society. And I say that tolerance is not enough. We hear the word tolerance as somehow that's the solution. As far as I'm concerned, tolerance just says, I'll put up with you. It doesn't say I'm going to support you, that I'm going to care about you, that I am going to be there for you in the tough places. I've been reading a lot of books in the last year or so. One of them, and perhaps you've read it, it was our Unitarian Universalist Association read for last year. It's called Just Mercy. It is a book by Brian Stevenson, who is a lawyer, graduated from Harvard, and is now the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He came to the South to find out about what was really going on, and this is the remarkable piece. Coming from a place of relative safety, he came and stayed in Alabama to do justice in the world, to change the incarceration of young children, to change the law that said that they could be tried as adults, and in fact could be executed as adults, something we don't like to think about. The fact is that he has stayed because he found there the opportunity to do something important, to do something real in the world. When we think about intolerance, we often think of the South as being the hotbed of intolerance. And I grew up there, and I can tell you probably a fair amount of that is true. But the thing that really galls me sometimes is the people that assume that if you're not from the South, then you're incredibly open-minded and tolerant. And I remember when we were planning for some sort of an action with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when a young woman was there from New York City and she said, you know, I like it better here because at least you know what the rules are. Back in New York, they tell you what the rules are, and then you have to find out that it's not true. So I'm here this morning to say that we are all a part of this issue today. We can look on the news. We can think about that something happening somewhere else. and say, well, you know, there are not very many people in Fullerton or in Southern California who have those kind of negative attitudes. Well, I think we're fooling ourselves. And I think we need to recognize that when people say, well, why should we talk about Black Lives Matter? All lives matter. And yes, they do. And that's what I'm talking about today, too. But if Black lives don't matter, then I'm not sure that any lives matter. This is the place we are right now. We need to deal with the circumstances that face us every day and recognize that the Syrian crisis that's now lifting its head is just another example of the kind of racism that is a part of our society today. I think of a story that was told when I was in seminary. It was a young Black man who was talking about an evening when he had somehow inadvertently driven into a white neighborhood and he didn't know how to get out of this neighborhood. And a policeman came up behind him, drove up behind him and parked his car and got out and said, get out of the car. He was just driving while Black, so that was the issue here. And this young man, who really was a little afraid, because this policeman hadn't said it very nicely, and he said, no, sir. And the policeman, did you hear me? I said, get out of the car. And he said, no, sir. And I don't know what changed in this policeman's mind when he was talking to this young man, but he looked at him and he said, is it really that bad out here? And this young man said, you have no idea. At which point, the policeman said, I'll drive my car in front. I'll show you how to get back home. But that kind of thing hasn't been happening in our country recently. People that have been asked to get out of their car have found themselves dead. And so we go on. The unconscious racial prejudice that is built into our culture, even though we ourselves may not, knowingly at least, be perpetrators of any crimes against others. It's built into our language. Here's a piece by Unitarian Universalist Jackie James, who says, Black male, black list, black mark, black Monday, black mood, black hearted, black plague, black mass, black market. Good guys wear white. Bad guys wear black. We fear black cats and the dark continent. But it's okay to tell a white lie. Lily white hands are coveted. It's great to be pure as the driven snow. Angels and brides wear white. Devil's food cake is chocolate. Angel's food cake is white. We shape language and we are shaped by it. In our culture, white is esteemed. It is heavenly, sunlight, clean, pure, immaculate, innocent, and beautiful. At the same time, black is evil, wicked, gloomy, depressing, angry, sullen. Ascribing negative and positive values to black and white enhances the institutionalization of this culture's racism. So what about Unitarian Universalists? We can be proud of the 19th century Unitarians such as Theodore Parker or Universalists like Benjamin Rush in fighting for the abolition of slavery and supporting the Underground Railroad. Unitarian John Haynes Holmes established the NAACP. Or about a resolution passed in May in 1942 by the American Unitarian Association, we hadn't yet combined the Unitarians and the Universalists, to endorse public commendation and support of government or other action which furthers racial and religious equality and brotherhood and public condemnation and effective counter-agitation against all forms of racial discrimination and religious prejudice. Unitarian Universalist or Unitarian minister at that point and social activist James Reeb was killed in Selma for his beliefs on March 11th in 1965 as a result of blows that he received by one of four white men after a dinner that he had shared with two other Unitarian Universalist ministers. UU Viola Liuzzo was inspired to go to Selma, where she lost her life to a sniper's bullet after she transported black marchers from Montgomery to Selma on March 25th, 1965. But that's not the whole story. It'd be easy for us to believe today that the establishment of the Unitarian Universalist Association, of the Task Force on Racism and the Black Concerns Working Group in 1985, along with the 1992 General Assembly resolution on racial diversity and multiculturalism, would solve all of our problems. To make us believe that we were all good people. We were not racist. And yet, in 1969, there was a walkout at General Assembly, because a group that had been established, a black working group, a council of black Unitarian Universalists, had been declared, and everybody was all excited, except for the fact that they weren't given any money to do their work. And so many men and women of color and their allies walked out of that General Assembly, many of them never to return to Unitarian Universalism, because we were talking a good line, but we weren't actually acting to support that. Our own Unitarian Universalist president, Bill Sinkford, the first, and I pray not the last, of our African-American presidents of the Unitarian Universalist Association, was one of those people who walked out. And he stayed away for quite a long time. He was one of the ones who came back. And so we would like to justifiably pride ourselves on some of these speeches and proclamations. The 1997 General Assembly in Phoenix established a great concern for anti-racism and multiculturalism, established a Jubilee World Workshop at that point, and I have participated in one of those workshops. But here's the question. Are the conditions for the vast number of black people really different in our country? Are they really, I shouldn't say are they different, are they better for our country? Are they better in our Unitarian Universalist congregations? We talk a good line, but we don't always follow through in ways that are helpful. Some of you perhaps read the book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, and you were maybe surprised, as I was, about some of her statistics. And I warn you, it's a hard read because she has lots of statistics. But the major things that she said were that there are more black people arrested in our country than any other single group. Those people get longer and stiffer sentences for the same crimes that are committed by white people. There's a greater percentage of blacks in prison than in our country as a whole. There are more black people on death row than any other group. And many of these people lose all of their rights because they are convicted of felonies that might for others simply be misdemeanors. And what about the murders of black people in our country by police and others? In recent years, from New York City to Los Angeles to Ohio to Ferguson, Missouri, and just this last week in North Carolina. And I worry about our current political rhetoric that's going on out there that's encouraging us to fear and be angry at and even attack those who are different from us. I went to a vigil in Thousand Oaks after the policemen were killed. And our job there was simply to say, we need to protect everyone. We need not to move out in anger against those people who are different from us, whether they be police or civilians. And at the end of that meeting, one of the things, and I thought this was an amazing thing to do, I was on the planning committee, but this was not my idea, that after the vigil, the vigil was not really totally over until we had found one person in that group that we did not know, to talk to that person, to find out those things that we shared in common, and to then say what it was that we were both going to do to make our lives safer, to make our lives more loving, to make othering people not okay. And it was really interesting because the person that I talked to was an African-American minister, so we did have that in common. He also had some relatives in Atlanta, Georgia, so we had that in common. But he gave me hope. Because one of the things I said, I'm in such great despair about our country, about how we're treating each other. And he, who could have said, yeah, it's really terrible, said to me, this kind of gathering is our hope. If we can get together and talk as equals, as people connected by our humanity, then there is hope. And I had to hug him and give him, thank you. Thank you for helping to lift at least a little bit of my despair. Because I think he was right. And then I went to General Assembly this year, which was billed as a General Assembly for welcoming everyone. And Bill Sinkford spoke at the Service of the Living Tradition about our need to speak up and step out on racial justice issues. He told his story of leaving the denomination and coming back. And then we delegates at that General Assembly had the opportunity to pass a study action issue that would have been discussed in congregations for 4 years about racial justice. And we didn't. We voted for something else. In the closing session, and I have to tell you, after that I really was back in despair again. Because if my own people can't vote for the right thing, I'm sorry, that sounds really egotistical, doesn't it, that I knew what the right thing was? But I did. It's true. In that particular case, I did. Not always, maybe. But in the closing session, teens, young adults, both black and white and Asian, went up on the stage, and they really told us off. Those of us who were sitting out there in the seats, and said, "You white people, oh my goodness, you know, where's my cover? You are not standing up for the things that you say you're standing up for." And in our denomination, they pointed out that we were being indicted for our lack of courage, our lack of compassion, our lack of really walking our talk. So this white person felt really, I kind of felt myself squirming and feeling really, really uncomfortable. We talk about standing on the side of love. Have it on my stole this morning. Standing on the side of love. We have a song that we sing about it. And that's all great. But the fact is that if we don't put that standing into walking, into acting, into doing, it doesn't really mean anything. It can just become a slogan that we say that makes us feel good about ourselves. We're standing on the side of love. How can that be bad? That we don't become so overcome with the horror of it that we give up and just say, "Nothing I can do." That we don't point our fingers at other people. "Well, if those police didn't do that, if those maniacs didn't do that, if those crazy people didn't do that, if those..." But just look at your finger when you do that. You got three of your fingers pointing back at yourself. So we need to talk about what we're doing, not what other people are doing out there. To find beloved community here, but not just leave it here. To take it out into the world. To spread it out all over the place. To educate ourselves about racism. And I've got to tell you, I wouldn't have told you maybe 15 years, 20 years ago that I was a racist. But I think I am. I think that there is something deep in our culture that makes us not question things about racism in our country. To make a difference, to speak out publicly. You speak out when one of your friends or acquaintances says something that's not okay. I'd say, "Well, I don't want to rock the boat." You need to rock some boats and rock some other things. To speak out, to stand up. And as Martin Luther King reminded us and keeps reminding us, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. One day, we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. We shall hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. But we can only do that if we're willing to put ourselves out there, to speak our truth, to speak our truth in love, and that's hard sometimes, because we just like to shout and scream at people and tell them they're doing it all wrong. But to speak our truth in love in a way that they can hear it and that we can hear it. Because we've got to hear it first before we can share it with other people out beyond this world. So my closing message is simply that we will act differently. out of that place our greatest hope and possibility. Act out of not just our own individual need, but the needs of so many of our people outside this place. And so I ask you all to leave this place a little different than when you came in, acknowledging our culpability and working to make the world a better place because we have been here. May we act from that place, and may we love all who enter our lives. Amen. Please turn now in your hymnal, your gray hymnal, to number 131. Love will guide us because it will. But we've got to let it in. I need a hymnal. Somebody have a hymnal?